The content here is for informational purposes only, should not be taken as legal, business, tax, or investment advice, or be used to evaluate any investment or security, and is not directed at any investors or potential investors in any A16Z fund. For more details, please see a16z.com/disclosures.
Welcome to the A16Z podcast. I'm Michael Copeland. How do you face down cancer, get told you can't get life-saving organ transplants, and go about getting them anyway? And in the middle of that mental and physical storm, how do you find the thing that you and only you were meant to do and start building it? One person who has the answers is Jim Gilliam, the founder of Nation Builder. And he's got the answers because that is exactly what he had to do, all of it. It's given Gilliam a clear philosophy on life and on being a leader. And what he's learned along the way, he says, is something everyone can tap into.
It's that multiple step process. One, believing that there is something that you're uniquely meant to contribute, finding what that thing is, and then having the audacity to say, I'm going to do it, and the humility to know that you can't do it by yourself. We've all got that. Everybody does. Got to find it.
Gilliam first told his story in a Break the Internet video, The Internet is My Religion. He's gone deeper with his recently published book of the same title. Ben Horowitz sat down with Gilliam on the occasion of his book launch to hear more about his philosophy on life, religion, leadership, and what we all can do to move this world forward.
So welcome, and I'm Ben Horowitz from Andreessen Horowitz. This is Jim Gilliam. He is the author who has come to tell us about his book, and we're very excited about that. Jim's also the founder, CEO of Nation Builder. So I'm going to ask Jim a few questions. We're going to talk a little about the book, and then we'll open it up for questions from everyone. So to get started, Jim, you were raised a fundamentalist Christian. You went to Liberty University. But your family didn't start out as fundamentalists. Tell us the story of, you know, how you got to that point, how your father kind of made that transition. What was the thing that triggered it?
When I was little, 3 or 4, we lived in upstate New York in Woodstock. And my dad worked at IBM. They had a big facility there in Kingston. And they launched this IBM PC, the big answer to the Apple II computer. But they didn't have any software for it. So they had this big employee software program. It's kind of like crowdsourcing would be today, because it was all within like the actual company, where they let any employee make software for the new PC, and then if it was good, they would distribute it and give royalties to the folks who were making it. And so my dad and his buddy, they weren't going to make solitaire. They decided to make an operating system.
And this is like in 1980, 81?
Yeah, this is 80, 82. Yeah, it started in 82. This was crazy. Like, the idea that you could
make... Yeah, writing a PC operating system, just like writing a PC operating system in 1982.
Yeah.
From scratch.
Right. Yeah, and one that like did more than one thing at a time on this like silly little like stupid computer.
Yeah, with multitasking, which didn't come out in PC operating systems for another 6 or 8 years after that.
Yep. And they did it. It blew everybody away, and all of IBM, and they like had a deal to distribute it. It was amazing. Like, IBM was going to have like their own operating system, and it was far superior to anything else on the market. They signed a deal to distribute it, and part of the deal was that my dad got this like sweet gig out at Almaden Research Center, which was the new big research center down near San Jose. And the day that he was packing up to move all of us out there, me and my mom and my two sisters were already actually in San Jose. He was packing up, and he gets a call from his buddy. I'm finding out that IBM had like just killed the deal. Like, it was off, it was over, that's not gonna happen.
Why'd they kill the deal?
So they killed the deal because of IBM didn't want to mess up the relationship with this new guy, Bill Gates, or his company, Microsoft. And So they gave him this, like, you know, they gave him 40 grand to shut him up, and they gave him, like, you know, 3 years in golden handcuffs, and they sent him off to San Jose to sweet new job. And my dad was, like, totally devastated. This is, like, everything. Like, he's a creator. He built stuff. He just loved that so much.
Probably even more devastated when he saw DOS.
Yes. 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 I spent a lot of time sitting next to him watching him type in DIR, like, over and over again. We moved to San Jose, and our house happened to be right across the street from this giant mega church. So this is the early 80s. It was the first of this kind of new form of church. There were like thousands and thousands of members. And we'd been Christians, like technically, but not really like into it. Like we didn't even go to church necessarily every Sunday up to that point. But when we came to San Jose, we started going to this church. And it just sucked us in. It was incredible. I mean, it was this whole community. There was a like sports leagues for all the kids. Like my dad coached soccer and baseball, and it was a whole thing. And but they had all these small groups and Bible studies, and they had these things called shepherding groups. My dad got involved in that, but he became really radicalized by some of the pastors there. In some of the books that they read, he thought about becoming a missionary. And I believe that he was trying to fill that hole that had left him in sort of wanting to believe in something so much. And he believed in IBM. It was the only company he ever wanted to work for. He like stopped going to school because like they were like, hey, come on, please work for us right now, because he was brilliant. And they ripped it all away. He lost total faith in that, and he threw it into Jesus. And that's how we became Christian fundamentalists.
Pretty good story. This is why you need to read the book. Like, it's just story after story that good. So you were raised fundamentalist Christian, but then at some point you lost your faith. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so growing up, obviously there was all this, a lot of Jesus. We were bros. But the internet, like the online and all that stuff was happening as well. This is sort of before the internet was really a thing. There's like BBSs and you know, all the old school people here will know what I'm talking about. Trade wars, that was my thing. So there was these like two kind of like almost opposing forces going on for my attention and my passions and whatnot. But as I grew up, I sort of went to college, went to Liberty University, and then I got cancer.
Liberty is Jerry Falwell's university.
It's the opposite of Liberty. Yeah. There are an immense number of rules. It literally Google the Liberty Way, and you will see all the different rules. Like there's about like the lengths of skirts and like the whole thing. But I got cancer, and that just really jolted me, as you can imagine. But even more so, my mom got cancer too, at the same time. 2 weeks after I was diagnosed, we were actually in the same hospital. I was like, "Mom, there's a clinic downstairs. Go and check it out. Get checked out." And she died 5 months later, and I survived. And as you can imagine, that's a big thing. Had a lot of survivor's guilt, trying to understand why did God save me and not her? She's such an amazing person. So that was like the first shot. I stopped going to church. I was really disillusioned with all of it. But if you had asked me, people who did ask me at the time, like, so do you believe and still believe in God? And I'd be, absolutely, he's just an asshole. But then ultimately after 9/11, fundamentalism really came to the fore. Again, it was a big deal. Am I really a fundamentalist? It really didn't seem that far away what was going on, brought the Trade Center down, like what was causing all this struggle in the world. If I had been born in Pakistan or Saudi Arabia, would like that have been me? Like that was, I was like, whoa. And so I started to Google. We had search engines now. I'd even worked at a search engine. I still hadn't figured out how to really use one, apparently. But I started Googling. It's like, oh, well, what is this Bible about? Like, who wrote it? Is this true? Because the thing about fundamentalism and how I was raised is that, you know, our big belief is that the Bible is the inerrant word of God. That's actually the phrase, inerrant word of God, meaning everything in it was word for word correct.
That comes from the Talmud, actually.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so if it wasn't, like, word for word accurate, then that was completely devastating, sort of the foundation of my belief system. And you can figure out that it's not word for word correct in about 45 seconds on the internet these days. Now, when I was a kid, you couldn't, yeah. Right? But you can now. And this is fundamentalism, right? There's plenty of Christians, in fact, vast majority of Christians, who would not at all argue that the Bible is the inerrant word of God, and it's much more rational and understandable outside of that. But for me, that's what it was. And so I just lost my faith. I was like, this isn't true. Like, the truth mattered a lot to me. Is this sort of factually true? And it wasn't. I'm like, this is crazy. I can't believe this. And I became an atheist. This was, shortly after 9/11.
So it's amazing because you're running an almost parallel inverse life to your father where, you know, he put everything he had into his work and then lost his faith in that and gained faith through religion, and you had all your faith in religion and lost that. So how did you get your faith back?
I worked really hard. So that experience in 9/11 turned me into an activist, and being an activist wasn't obvious how to do that back in 2001, 2002, and but I was going to figure it out. I read a book by Michael Moore. It was called Stupid White Men. I was like, the answer must be in here. And there was this, like, you know, inset, you know, thing in one of the pages. And there was like 10 steps to like take back the country or whatever. And one of the things said, take over your local Democratic Party. Like, his thesis was that it's like all run by a bunch of old people. So if like bring in sort of new people, then you can like take over the whole thing and like actually do some good with it. Cause it's, you know, it's the Democratic Party, you can do something with it, right? So I tried to do that and it was just completely pointless. But at the same time, there was this new guy that was like, you know, lighting up the internet. His name was Howard Dean. This is 2003. And I was like, okay, I get this meetup. Had sort of burst onto the scene. It was like people coming together through the internet, like in real life, to organize around political candidates. It just intuitively made sense to me. MoveOn really came onto the scene. Again, similar ideas, like bringing people together over the internet to sort of make something happen. Again, intuitively, I got it. So I got really involved in this stuff. Eventually, I connected with a filmmaker. We started making movies and documentaries, and we used the power of organizing people and bringing people together through the internet to change the stories about what was going on in Iraq, what was going on with Fox News, and all of these things that we felt were really taking the country in this wrong direction. We were able to use people connected through the internet to have an impact there. And not really realizing it, I developed an immense faith in that power, but it didn't really come to, I didn't really get it until I needed a double lung transplant.
So why'd you need a double lung transplant?
So the cancer treatments that I had actually cancer twice around the same time. And I'd had a bone marrow transplant and a bunch of chemo and a bunch of radiation. And it was 8-10 years later that all of those treatments had scarred my lungs to the point where I couldn't breathe. That's pretty unusual. Usually if that's gonna happen, it happens within a year or two. But for me, it took a really long time. It took a really long time to figure out what was going on. So my lungs had to get replaced. But because I'd had cancer, it was very difficult for the transplant programs to justify giving me the lungs, because the likelihood that I would reject them and that they would waste a very precious resource on someone like me who couldn't really take advantage of it was too much. So they rejected me outright, said, nope, you're not a good candidate at all. And so I went on the internet and I blogged about it. I vented a lot. I threatened to register UCLA surgeons are pussies.com. Some of the folks who were like reading my blog and sort of were following what was going on, one of them sent an email to UCLA and was like, what's going on? This is crazy. Like, you're only doing easy surgeries. No wonder your statistics are so great. It's not okay. And a whole bunch more people did that. And eventually they let me come in. They brought me in for an appointment. We had to bust through so many different things to make it happen, but it was, again, the same story. People connected through the internet, people I didn't even know, people I would never even know, made it possible for me to live. It was the realization that I physically could not live without two other people, like in my body. You can be pretty dense about things, but even I got that. I breathe through someone else's lungs while someone else's blood flows through my veins. I have a new faith in the power of people connected, people I don't even know. I literally bleed and breathe that every day.
And kind of out of your faith has come a life philosophy, if you will, about human potential and leadership and so forth. And can you kind of tell us a bit about that and how you think about the world these days, and not only your own life and how others might think about theirs?
I am, because of this great gift, I felt this immense responsibility to give back. It was like this debt that I had to repay. And it's crazy, there's no way you can repay a debt like that. I knew it, but I was still gonna try. And so it's like, okay, well, what is the thing that I can uniquely contribute? Like, what is it that that no one else can do that I can do? That can make it maybe a little bit worthwhile, all of this immense grace that I have experienced. And so I like to build things. Ultimately, this is what became Nation Builder. But I believe that similarly, everybody has something that they are uniquely meant to contribute. It is very difficult to figure out what that thing is. And in fact, it frequently changes over time. For me, it became sort of very clear that what I was meant to create is infrastructure for people to bring folks together on the internet to sort of make whatever it is that they want to make happen. But that thing, that if once you figure out what that thing is that you actually want to do, that not even want to do, that you have to do because no one else could, almost all the time, you cannot do that by yourself. You need other people. And that can really suck, that realization. And it's only when you care about that thing so much that you have to make it happen, that you're willing to put up with all of the hardship that's involved in bringing other people to make it happen, that you're willing to do what it takes to be a leader. And that's the whole thing. If that's multiple step processes, one, believing that there is something that you're uniquely meant to contribute, finding what that thing is, which for me is a lot about understanding your story and stuff like that. There's a whole set of stuff that we've tried to start to figure out there. Understanding what that thing is, and then having the audacity to say, I'm going to do it, and the humility to know that you can't do it by yourself. We've all got that. Everybody does. Got to find it.
I'm fired. I gotta go start something. So kind of one last question. So then when you take that mission, how did that translate into 3DNA Corp or Nation Builder? And why Nation Builder, and What's the mission of the company, and what are you trying to do there?
So 3DNA Corp, as you can imagine, when I was waiting for the transplant, I had this realization that there was going to be three different DNAs in my body. And I was like, this is amazing. If I live, I'm going to start a company called 3DNA. I have no idea what it's going to do. And that was the thing that kept me going, was that, like, you know, I'm going to get better so that I can build something again. And that process started with, like, okay, this idea of bringing democracy to democracy. That was, like, the idea after I got the transplant and Obama had gotten elected and stuff like that. And I didn't really know what that looked like, but I thought that there had to be something there that no one was really looking at. And I started working with a congressional candidate in New York on what I thought was like a campaign platform. You know, it'd be like social media, volunteers, and things like that. And as I was working with her, I realized that the problems that I was solving here were just like the problems that I had been an activist and organizing people around the movies, just like the problems that we'd had in like organizing people to help me get the lungs. It's leaders bringing together this loosely knit group of people to just make something happen. And that's called leadership. It's existed for a really long time. And there is just this immense opportunity for people to do that now. In fact, there's a study done a few years ago by Pew. And they went and they identified 27 different types of groups, everything from like political parties and unions to like fantasy sports leagues. And they went and they asked them a bunch of different questions. Right? One of the questions was, why do you leave a group? And the number one reason by far, 54% of people said the reason they leave a group is because of a lack of leadership. So what I believe is happening is that the internet is connecting everybody at a scale that's unimaginable. We all know that, right? And if you think about it, right, every highly successful technology has fundamentally been about connecting people. Cars, planes, television, the telephone, the wheel. Internet's this crazy version of this. So all these people are coming, they're connected together. But then because of a lack of leadership, all of that potential is just getting squandered. So if we can connect that thing that each of us is uniquely meant to contribute in the world, that thing that is in us, if we can find that, and we can connect it with all the people that genuinely want to come together to build communities and sort of be connected with each other, to like tap into that and become leaders of that, to sort of actually then make that happen. I mean, talk about a wealth explosion. I mean, it's like, even just 1% more of that, 2% more of that would just be like world-changing. And so that's the vision behind Nation Builder. We're in the trenches, like building that infrastructure for when there's something you care about so much that you're willing to like become a leader. You're willing to sort of do what all of that takes. Like, it's not easy, but the technology is possible now. We've got it all in one system. We can like do all the different things that kind of help you keep track of all of it and help lead people to making things happen, all those things. But it still requires you to really want it and be willing to make all those sacrifices, something that Ben talks about all the time, particularly with me.
You have to make yourself uncomfortable all the time. Yeah. Okay, well, thank you, Jim. That was pretty awesome stories, yeah.